If you're in the market for a super addictive puzzle game, you have to check out Mini Motorways on Apple Arcade. It's a city planning strategy puzzler with an incredibly satisfying gameplay loop. Enjoy unlimited access to over 200 incredibly fun games with no ads and no in-app purchases. From puzzle and adventure games to sports, racing, and multiplayer action games, everyone can count on finding something to love. Head to sifter.com.au/arcade to start your free trial of Apple Arcade today. That's sifter.com.au/arcade for a free 1 month trial of Apple Arcade, and you'll be supporting independent video games journalism. New subscribers only, $9.99 a month after free trial. Plan automatically renews after trial until cancelled.
Hello and welcome again to another episode of Pixel Sift. My name is Gianni and this is episode 74 of Pixel Sift. Each week we do this show where we look at the gaming news, we look at stuff that's making the rounds in the world of developers. We talk to people who make amazing games like Yonder, the Cloudcatcher Chronicles, and we're joined this week by Cheryl Vance and Joel Stiles from Prideful Sloth. We're very excited to talk to you. Thanks for joining us today.
Hello.
Good to be here.
And we'll be taking a look at some other stuff today, Mitch. What else are we checking out?
Yeah, so we're taking a look at the target demographics of consoles, who's playing what.
And lastly, what happens when players use mechanics like quicksave a little bit too much? And does that move the feel of the games from what away from what the developer has intended? Let's jump in, shall we?
Did you know Pixel Sift is available on other platforms? You can find previous episodes on iTunes, Pocket Casts, YouTube, and on the Pixel Sift website. So this week I was reading an article by Nathan Birch. His piece criticized PlayStation and Xbox systems for not fostering the growth of the gaming community. His main point was that at the moment, both Microsoft and Sony seem to be pushing more games for mature audiences, with Nintendo seeming to be the only system catering toward a more younger gamer.
Now, Joel and Cheryl, you're making a game that's catering towards, and correct me if I'm wrong, it looks like it's catering towards a younger gamer or maybe a family-friendly sort of title. Do you agree with this assessment that Nintendo is the only one that's kind of pushing things in that direction?
So first off, actually, you know, the game that we're making is the game I wanted to play, so we're targeting me. So
it's always a good place to start.
It's actually a byproduct that we found that the game has a much broader appeal than we ever realized it did. And it's wonderful to know that it can actually reach a larger audience, including, you know, younger family members. So as for consoles, we've been working with Sony very closely on making, you know, as well as PC, but specifically to answer the console question with Sony. And we've got a lot of support from Sony to bring Yonder out. So that's a really interesting one. From my point of view, they're very nurturing and fostering of our project. So, and I think they want to broaden their demographics.
Do you think there's there's often a question when we have big press conferences that it's your big AAA titles at your E3s and things like that, and they seem to be targeted at a specific type of audience. Do you think this is a misinterpretation of that targeting, and that maybe people are only seeing the things that they want to see, and they're not seeing things that are not immediately catching their eye?
I think ultimately it's where the money's at, or it's at least perceived where the money's at. So for the main part, you know, we've had this industry which for the longest time has been targeting the male-centric younger to teen to maybe 30 years of age sort of demographic. And that's what we've known. That's what we've really done well at for how long now. But now that the whole world is considered a gaming audience, I think that's really opened up those horizons. And honestly, I think it's just the speed of adoption and the speed of knowing how to market and really attract that audience. I think that's the big question at the moment, is just how to really get that audience and just basically, it's not a question of the product, it's just how to talk and reach out to those audiences.
With your game, how are you kind of reaching out to the people that you'd like to play your game or would find value in playing your game? You know, what are some of the tactics that you're kind of employing to do that?
So we've actually got a PR firm in place too, and so we're utilizing them heavily to go out to the media, because the media has a much larger reach as a whole than we do as an individual independent studio. And it would take us a long time to build up even a small sliver of a community that some of these larger outlets have. So that's a big point for us. Having said that, we still also make sure that we use social media, Twitter, Facebook. Those are kind of our two main sort of outreaches. And then also we're very active within the Steam community on our discussion forums there as well, too, because we want to make sure that we're talking to all the different people who might be invested in Yonder and making sure we try and deliver to them what they're looking for.
You talked about making the game that you wanted to play and something that you were looking to enjoy yourself, and you found that it had this broader appeal. How did you kind of discover that, and how did you, has that had any impact on the way that you've made the game into the future?
So it was by happenstance that we gave a copy of a build to some friends, and they didn't play it. They gave it to their two youngest daughters to play, and they loved it. And that's kind of where we learned that we probably had a broader audience than we realized, which is an interesting conundrum, because that also starts impacting things like how you write your game as well, too. How many words you start displaying on the screen, and a number of other things that, you know, fall into that. That bit of a rabbit's hole to go down to talk about all the things that introduced to us. So, yeah, I mean, that's how we started it. As for how we sort of, I guess, continue to develop and work on that, and how we continue to talk to those audiences after development, it's, I think, more of a thing of just basically those two young girls were kind of our test case for a long time, and they continued to play it and look at it as we were developing it. And our first time of getting a broader audience's hands-on was at PlayStation Experience back in December when we first announced the game, and that went really well. And then again, we showed it off at PAX East in Boston, and that was great, because that gave us those two shows gave us such a broad audience to sort of get feedback and understanding of audience types out of.
Is there a, I know you talked about a lot about the community you're building on Steam and the support that you've had from PlayStation as well. Do you think there is a platform that Yonder just wouldn't work on? Is there something that you think just isn't a good fit?
Well, for the most part, we've talked about different platforms that, you know, we would love to see it on, or like how it would change the dynamic of the game. And for the most part, I think a lot of it comes down to just the technical capabilities of a platform. So, for instance, we'd love to see it on a handheld, but like before the Switch, I mean, that just wouldn't have been possible to see, like, you know, a open world, like, you know, massive streaming sort of style, technical requirement. You know, it wouldn't have been possible on the 3DS, or, you know, you would have really struggled to push that on Vita. But I think with the Switch now, that's kind of been overcome. So that's something to visit again later on.
So how accurately can you gauge your audience at the moment? Is it possible to find out exactly what ages you're kind of getting through the game?
No, not at all. It's too broad. We had kids as young as, without being a parent, I'm going to take a stab in terms of age range of about 4 or 5 playing the game at PAX. But then we also had some lovely gentlemen that were older, you know, even in their 50s and 60s coming in and playing the game. So such a broad audience. There was even there was an article written. Oh, and I just was talking with them on Twitter, and I'm going to forget. But basically, they wrote an article at PAX saying how they walked up to the booth and saw kids playing the game and thought, I've made a bad mistake. This isn't a game for me. But once they sat down and played it, they realized it's not. They absolutely love the game. And we have, they're over in the US, and the guy has ordered in Tim Tams as well. So he's getting himself set up to play the game.
The full Australian experience.
So.
Did that worry you that some people might be turned off just by I guess, the visual aspect of it? And did that make you make some decisions about how it should look?
I think for the most part, it's actually been really eye-opening to see that. Well, actually, let me just back a little on this. For the most part, like, we've always been taught in like large development and traditional development that a demographic is more so defined by a group of habits, like, you know, habitual game playing. So, you know, Harry Hardcore versus Cammy Casual. And honestly, it's at this sort of scale, that's really not true. Like, you know, you can't really shoehorn demographics into those sorts of categories. And we've found that, like, for our game, even tackling it from, like, you know, just a purely visual sort of point of view, like you mentioned, we've had people that are, like, you know, really excited by that look. Just because, like, you know, they feel like, oh, that looks cool. It looks cute. It looks, like, you know, warm and inviting. But then there's others which are, like, you know, the older male, more would have fit into the hardcore gaming category. They're like, okay, that looks really nostalgic. It's like, oh, that reminds me of this thing that I liked 10 years, 15 years ago. And that's kind of cool as well.
And I think really, in getting out into these trade shows and talking with people, it's really made us realize that putting age groups and genders to people playing your games does a disservice to everybody, including us. Because what we really realized is we need to talk about people who like certain game mechanics or like certain styles of game or certain paces of game, rather than are you X and Y. We need to say, oh, it's people who like simulation games, people who like farming games, people who like exploration games. We really, it's such a broad thing, and it really opened our eyes as to how we need to probably internally talk more about our audiences in the future.
It's interesting. The subject of that article, who was kind of criticizing, saying that they weren't fostering the growth, you know, has a long history of experience with those things. Previously worked at Sony Entertainment Europe, mm-hmm. Also worked at Microsoft Game Studios for a time. It seems like it's kind of from, and correct me if I'm sort of paraphrasing here, but it does seem sort of reductive to kind of be breaking people into this is a new gamer and this is a hardcore gamer or an established gamer.
Essentially, that's what he's doing in the article, actually.
Is that something you agree with, that it's kind of a damaging thing to think about as games as a whole, to break people into just these small little categories?
It's not necessarily breaking them into small categories. I think it's just how we define those categories. We need to look at them differently. I mean, it's... Categories exist for a reason, because they help give us a starting point in which to hold a conversation, and they give us a starting point in which people can all, you know, sort of come to a common understanding about a conversation. So how we change, you know, whether you, like you said, the new gamer or the hardcore gamer, whatever those are, you know, there's a definite way that we can all still understand the types of people we're talking about, but tackle it from a different way. Like I said, if I said, you know, this is people who like adventure mechanics, we all understand what adventure mechanics are too. We all understand what farming mechanics are. And so we strip out the, are you hardcore? Are you new? Whatever. And you start, you know, drilling down into who are the people that like these sorts of play styles.
You know, we've got some statistics here, and, you know, it says that households that own a device that's used for playing games is 65%, or if they own a device that's just exclusively for playing games is at 48%, which is a pretty universal experience. I think it's, you know, it's well known that everyone plays games these days.
I wonder if that's a take into account people that have both.
Yeah, well, there must be some sort of Venn diagram overlappy sort of circle things that have kind of come into that. It's really fascinating, and I think this conversation is going to be ongoing as we have newer and even you know, greater types of games for different types of experiences and all that sort of thing. But right now, though, let's jump into our next topic.
Pixel Sieve!
It's not Pixel Sieve. It's Pixel Sift.
Pixel Sieve!
So joining us over the line, we have Cheryl Vance and Joel Stiles. They're from the studio Prideful Sloth. We've been talking a little bit about their game, Yonder, The Cloudcatcher Chronicles. Now, for people who haven't seen it, we've been talking about the sort of appeal and what sort of people might be interested in your game. What is Yonder, The Cloudcatcher Chronicles? What is it?
So the elevator pitch is Yonder is an open world exploration and adventure game with farming, crafting, fishing, and lots of other little fun things to do to spend your time in a beautiful, vibrant world.
And how did you build that beautiful, vibrant world? I was watching an interview that you did earlier on, and you were talking about how you wanted to build sort of familiarity into the game so that even if people had been to a place for the first time, they would kind of know where they were. What are some of the important things about building a world like that?
Oh, gee, there's so much that actually goes on behind the scenes to, you know, just make even the smallest of areas. But I guess one of the more interesting things to talk about with that would probably be, like, you know, from a more high-level approach. So when we were designing it, we kind of did the whole, okay, cool, we'll make as much of as interesting variants of like, you know, different areas, different things that you can discover and find. And we were just trying to throw amounts of things at the problem. And it wasn't until we kind of took a step back and thought, well, what do people actually find engaging? What do they find endearing? What is meaningful to a person, like, you know, in an environment or in a situational context? And from that, we really tried to burrow into, like, you know, just more the things which give a psychological impact. So
what's a good example of one of those? Like, what's something that you know, has that resonance that people can kind of connect to?
So a great example of that would probably be one of the areas in the game that we've got is called Dapplewood Forest. And basically it's a fairly cliche sort of area of, like, you know, a very vegetative, overgrown forested area. And the thing that we really tried to bend that around was that really peaceful, tranquil feeling of, like, you know, soft autumn hues and like, you know, sunlight streaming through the leaves, all those sorts of lovely things that you would associate with a British forest in autumn. And so we basically try to pull these sorts of core things instead of, you know, just trying to go, cool, well, you know, there's going to be trees and there's going to be bushes and there's going to be huts and all these things. We try to instead make it all gravitate or orbit around these nice psychological elements.
How do you go about that? Is it as simple as, say, you know, flicking through a book of photos and saying, yeah, that works? Or do you start with the idea and think, how are we going to achieve this and go look for examples? How do you, you know, build that up?
So it's a really interesting process, which obviously it's a bit of a tough one to talk about because there's so many intangible things that are, like, kind of around this. Like, so much of it has got to do with, like, you know, what makes you feel comfortable, what makes you feel like something is homely, or like, you know, even down to things like the smell of rain, those sorts of things, those sorts of elements that we don't usually consider when building environments where, like, you know, we're just usually looking at what is a cool thing. We're trying to basically find those things that resonate with people on that sort of level. So that can be individual people in the team, like, you know, they have a fond memory of something, or like, you know, it's a social thing or a cultural thing, or it's like, okay, great, there's the great love of the maple forests or the sakura blooms in Japan. So those sorts of elements we try to weave in or use as central topics for these areas.
You've spoken about when you created Yonder that it was going to be sort of like a safe and gentle world. And why was that such an important thing for you to include in this game?
It's for me, just a lot of the games I tend to play, not all of them. I mean, don't get me wrong. I have a broad, repertoire of games I play. But some of the ones that I do enjoy playing and for different moods are, you know, your Harvest Moons, your Story of Seasons, Animal Crossings, those sorts of games, where it's more about just going about doing things in your own time, as opposed to going about and, you know, being, you know, feeling like you need to rush through something or that you're getting into combat to do things. And it's also something that I really wanted. It sounds sort of dumb, but I love the fact that I can make a game that my aunt has now gone out and bought a PlayStation to go play, you know, and has bought the game and she's going to play it because she's not a gamer. She's, you know, she doesn't own a console at all, but she's seen the videos and she wants to play it because she wants to learn how to play a game to play it because it's something that she's not going to be punished in learning how to play. And to me, that's amazing that I can make something that people who in my family wouldn't have otherwise ever owned a console have now gone out and bought them so that they can pick it up and play it. It's to me, it's a very special thing.
That's got to be an amazing feeling to kind of see people connecting to your game in this way. You know, you've had a lot of people kind of play your game at these consoles, at the conventions, and having people come up and play it there. Are people kind of communicating that same sort of experience to you, that they've sort of found that familiarity or they've found that connection in something there? Is that something that people say to you outwardly, or can you just see it on their face?
You can definitely see it on their face. There's certain things like when the first time people pick up and they jump off the cliff and the umbrella, you know, pops open, you see this amazing delight on their faces as well. But also, you know, just to step back a little bit from the conference side too, and we've gotten lots of lovely feedback, but you know, that's a little bit of a bubble when you take that into account, because at the same side, somebody would really have to dislike your game to stand around long enough to tell you to your face that they dislike your game. They're more than likely going to walk off and not say anything. So, like I said, the feedback has been beautiful, but I also accept that there's an audience out there that probably looked at it and thought, you know, I don't like this game, it's not for me, and walked off and never said anything as well.
Do you think, I don't know if you've had any experience with that, but, you know, having that experience of seeing people play your game in real life is different, obviously, to people talking about it online. How has the online community sort of been, and what are sort of some of the things that you've got from their experience of looking at the game?
I've actually found it a very odd experience this time around. Like, we come from a more traditional development, AAA sort of background. And so we're used to, like, you know, just release a game, don't read the comments, because 90% of what you read is just going to be horrible, horrible, horrible stuff. But it's been the absolute opposite this time around, which has been really odd.
We have a lovely community. The people on Twitter, on Steam, I totally get that there's a group of people that don't want to play our game, and we understand that. You know, that's kind of the point of a free market, isn't it? You don't have to buy what you don't want to buy. So, but, you know, I'm quite proud of our community. They're actually really lovely people. And it's interesting, those that haven't played the game, some of them have gone through and watched every gameplay video they can. Some of them have said that they're not watching anything because they don't want to ruin the experience for themselves as well, too. So, you know, it's quite a broad range. But I even had one of the guys reach out and say he showed his young son, and his young son wants to do his first Let's Play video, and he wants to use Yonder. So, you know, it's such a huge, you know, varying audience, but 90% of it's beautiful.
The one that I was surprised at was so we've got the demo up and running in the, in like Target or Walmart, those sorts of places. They've got the PlayStation kiosks, the little booths that you can play on. Mm-hmm. So we've got a demo up on there in the United States. And we've heard back from a number of people basically saying that they've been driving around trying to find these things so that they can play them.
For like hours. And yeah. Some people have been like 2 hours of driving to try and find their nearest kiosk so that they could play the demo.
Are these people organizing? Yeah. Are they on Yonder Watch? Have they got a little geotags and things like that as soon as they find a console?
There's, I do actually think there's a few people trying to share locations of where they found them. I truly do.
We've got, speaking of that sort of experience and that people have talked about, Rosha H has asked whether the experience of the game is sort of strongly developed with a backstory for the character itself, or is the aim to kind of put the player in the game as a blank slate and they make what they will of it?
I would say it's a bit of a mid-ground between those two. We want to give enough context into the world so that you have a goal and that there's a reason to be there and things to do. But we also do want the character to have a bit of a blank slate within that world so that each player has a room to interpret and put upon that their own adventures. I liken it to sort of playing Skyrim or, you know, the Bethesda games. There's always a story there. But your adventure and my adventure in that game are very different. And we might have the same overarching narrative, but what you did and what I did in the 60 hours to finish that narrative is completely different. And that's what kind of we want to make sure the players have, is that ability when they talk about it to have completely different adventures.
One of the things I was really curious about, you've talked about coming from a bigger studio sort of background and working in different sort of environment beforehand. How many people are working on the game at the moment? And how has that experience been moving from a bigger team into a smaller team to make this game and be shipping it next week-ish?
Oh, geez, our pulse races when you say next week-ish.
ish, I said. It's a bit sorry. More than next week.
So our core team is three developers, so not many people, obviously. So we've got another person on for support from like a business sort of perspective. And then we've had the very good luck of having a number of people that we work closely with as outsourcers throughout the lifetime of the project. And that's around about six or seven other people there. The core team is only three people, so that's what we've got on at the moment.
And because of the ramp up and ramp down of that, that puts us, like Joel said, at about five to six for the main chunk of development. But the first part was actually one to two, and then we ramped up to three, and then, you know, went from there, and now we've ramped back down. So we're like a core team of three, like you said, but we do have some support from social media and business and all the it takes a lot to make a game. It really does.
How long have you been working on this game from start to finish?
Oh, geez. From start to finish, probably around about 3.5 years now, possibly a little bit longer.
But having said that too, that was kind of working, you know, while we were working and doing things, this was a little thing that we touched on the weekends when we had spare time, and we developed a prototype, and then we put that prototype down to then, you know, start talking with publishers and talking to people for funding and reaching out and trying to make sure we could get Yonder off the ground. And so full-time development on it has been around it's not been a year and a half. I think it's, what has it been? February 2016 we started. So
a bit over a year and 4 months-ish almost.
Yeah.
So I guess we've talked to, bringing it right back to the PlayStation aspect of it. And like you said, you mentioned you had like booths and stores in America. But like we talked to quite a few Australian developers about that had the opportunity to put their games on the PlayStation Store. And their stories have all been quite different. So how did the process start for you guys?
I actually back in the UK knew somebody that had come from the Sony, I'm trying to think of what their name was. Basically, it was what would have been, it was Shahid's team. If you know who Shahid is, obviously he's left Sony since then, but I think it's like external developer relations or whatever that team was at the time. And he put us in touch with Shahid. And then obviously Shahid went into his team internally and they did a review of the project and looked at it for suitability. It went through, they have sort of market analysis people in there as well too that look at it. So it went through a wide process and Sony was very, very interested in working on the project, trying to get it onto PlayStation and work with us to get it onto PlayStation. So we've had a lot of support from them ongoing, and that team even after Shahid left, and we worked with other people as well too, and now we have Nick in the UK looking after us. Everybody's been lovely and supportive to help us get this out.
Yeah, I think the main thing there was that Sony's got their finger on the pulse. They know what they're doing. But one of the main things that was attractive for them was trying to broaden that audience appeal, which I guess is part of what we've been talking about as well. And so obviously Yonder is all about a broad audience appeal. So I think from that sort of perspective, that was right up their alley at that point.
And I mean, that process and talking to them, and when we say that and we're like, oh yeah, just through these people, not a problem. That was still probably before we got sort of approval and platform approval and you know, just internal team support from their indie team, as opposed to just going solo with a release. That took 6-7 months of time. It was not particularly, you know, when we gloss over it and say this, it sounds like it was, you know, a week, and it was it was many a month to get through that process.
We've got another question from Rosha asking that once you get to the finish line of this game, when you get to that 100% point, you've got to send it off. Is that a satisfying experience? Is it frustrating to be at that point because there's many things you'd like to change? How does that make you feel at that point of the development cycle?
It's never going to be 100%. It's like any form of art ever. You do it and then you kind of put it out into the world and you instantly go, oh no, critique it. All these things are wrong. And so for us, it'll probably never be 100%. That we already have a whole bunch of things in the back of our head that we want to do to improve, add to the game, add to the experience. And so, you know, we're hoping that, you know, 6 months, 7 months down the road, we're still working and making Yonder an even more exciting experience than it is now.
I can definitely relate to that experience. You know, you can be working on things and they don't quite work, and you keep looking at yourself in the past and you go, could do that better the next time. So
yeah, it takes as long as the time you have.
Exactly.
Absolutely.
100% and I mean,
We felt great getting in. We felt great, you know, getting ready to get it out, but we're still working on it right now. You know, it doesn't, you know, submission doesn't mean stop. Submission just means that's a cutoff point that you have to accept. And we're still working on it. You know, we're still doing point updates on Steam right now before release, and getting, you know, plans in place to do a patch for Sony as well too, because we just see all the flaws, and so we want to fix all the flaws.
Well, look, it looks very good. We're very excited to give it a go when it comes out on the 18th. Of July. It's called Yonder, the Cloud Catcher Chronicles. It's on Steam and it's on PlayStation. You know, Cheryl and Joel are working very hard right now. We've taken them away from that for them to get this game out to you. If you want to find out more info about it, you can head to yonderchronicles.com. We've kind of reached the end of the show. We would love to have chatted to our other topic, but it was fascinating hearing about how you've kind of put the game together. I've got one sort of final question that I wanted to know. You've worked in this smaller team now, and you've worked in previous teams which were bigger. Is it a small team going forward, or would you like to move back into a bigger team for future projects?
I think we can each answer that separately, so I'll let Joel go first.
Uh-oh.
So I feel like I've done the big thing. I've done the small stuff. I'd like to aim for a mid-tier sort of thing. And I guess by mid-tier, I'm still aiming small. So, like, I would be super comfortable with 10 people, extremely dedicated and focused people. I think that's the big cincher for me, is that as you grow as a company, as you pull in more and more people, you need more management, you need more breadth of ability, and that really has a huge overhead. And personally, I would like to avoid that. I find it much more compelling to work in a more agile, smaller sort of setup. I feel like I can do more when there's less. Less is more, basically, I guess, is what I'm saying in this sort of context.
And now, for the dissenting opinion.
I mean, it's not necessarily dissenting at all. I kind of would like to keep it a tad bit smaller. I think five or six as opposed to 10 would be nice. I get where Joel's coming from. I think the biggest thing is for us, we saw exactly how quickly when certain things came about that we could move in, you know, for thanks to Silicon Valley, we can use the word pivot now. So, you know, we could pivot very quickly and, you know, get things done that otherwise weren't on our main path at that point. And that's an amazing thing. We had a point where we had to get, what was it, 6 or 7 builds out in 2 weeks. And so 6 or 7 SKUs out, 2 weeks, and we had to get our entire localization pipeline in and get text localized and back and tested. And that was, we did it. And yet we've all been on, you know, some large teams too. And those sorts of things can take large teams down. And it's not because the teams themselves are terrible. They're not. We're working with some of the best people in the world. It's just the larger the ship is, the harder it is to get it to move and steer. And so, you know, I think we do all kind of really appreciate and enjoy the small team, the smaller teams, because we've got the ability to move quickly.
Well, look, it's very exciting, and it's really, I'm really looking forward to the game coming out next week. Not next week, on the 18th of July, which is a Tuesday.
Come on, Johnny, we have one job.
I'm going to play it next week, so I've got that in my head. So, thanks for joining us. This is Pixel Sift. We do this every fortnight. We also do alternating streams as well. We can put up all the links to the game. You can find it on Steam. You can find it and add it on your wish list. You can jump on the PlayStation Store, and I think you can pre-order it right now. You can find that website at www.pixelsift.com.au. Where else on the social web, Mitch, can people find our information and links?
Yeah, you can find us on facebook.com/pixelsift, twitter.com/pixelsieve, twitch.tv, well, you already know that if you're watching this anyway, but twitch.tv/pixelsieve, and youtube.com/pixelsieveau.
And we also have a bunch of previous episodes that you can check out. You can listen on iTunes, sorry, it's Apple Podcasts. You can listen on Google Play if you're in the States. You can listen pretty much anywhere you get a podcast. That's it for this week. Thank you very much, Cheryl and Joel, for joining us. We're very excited for your game, and we'll catch everyone next week.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
If you're in the market for a super addictive puzzle game, you have to check out Mini Motorways on Apple Arcade. It's a city planning strategy puzzler with an incredibly satisfying gameplay loop. Enjoy unlimited access to over 200 incredibly fun games with no ads and no in-app purchases. From puzzle and adventure games to sports, racing, and multiplayer action games, everyone can count on finding something to love. Head to sifter.com.au/arcade to start your free trial of Apple Arcade today. That's sifter.com.au/arcade for a free 1 month trial of Apple Arcade, and you'll be supporting independent video games journalism. New subscribers only, $9.99 a month after free trial. Plan automatically renews after trial until cancelled.